This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Check out my Facebook page, Radio Joy on Paper, and let me know if you have an author that you want me to invite on the program. I am always looking for suggestions, so just go to my Facebook page, Radio Joy on Paper, and let me know. My next guest actually was high on my list for the past year to get on this program, and my brother, Tom, and his wife, Debbie, absolutely adore the next author. They have all his books, and they read them over and over, and I so very happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Nick Bantock. Hi, Nick.
Good morning.
Oh, wow. It is nice to talk to you. As I said, of course, you are famous for your absolutely marvelous saga of Griffin and Sabine, and which I don't know how many millions and millions of copies you have sold, but it is such a popular series. And last year, of course, Pharos came out, so it was very exciting.
It was, it's strange because it's 25 years since the very first one came out, Griffin and Sabine, back in 91. So going around that circuit again and talking to people about the books, it's been quite fascinating. I mean, just seeing my own take on it.
Well, certainly anybody who has read your books will never forget them. From the moment it's in their hand, it is a special something that is unlike any other experience in reading. Now, we'll explain to the listeners who might not know that the series Griffin and Sabine is what they call a novel of epistology, right?
Yes, it's a series of postcards and letters, where you see both the image on one side of the postcard and then on the back what's written on it. And then in the case of the letters, you come to a page and you actually see an envelope. You get to open the envelope, take the letter out, and you get to read somebody else's mail. And it's a story initially set in London, and the story of Griffin, who is a very sort of lonely, miserable kind of guy, an artist, and one day he suddenly gets a postcard from a stranger on the other side of the world, and thus begins something that's both a love story, a mystery, an alchemical journey. It's many, many different things layered one on top of the other.
Now, the story of Griffin Moss and the woman who becomes part of his life, Sabine Strohem, is so remarkable in many ways. First of all, they don't meet. They are just corresponding to each other. And you have created, of course, you are a brilliant artist. And as a matter of fact, I think there's now they call a sort of a Bantockian style of art, because your art is so special. It combines
stamps. Almost every single material under the sun.
Exactly.
From paint to ephemera, stamps, and all integrated and worked into individual pieces. But there's also within the cards and the letters, there are many other forms: drawing, pastel, acrylics, oil. In fact, it's been one of the fun things during my career as an artist, which started, I guess, when I was 16 years old, when I first went to art college. I've always been in, rather than going in one narrow direction, as the art world tends to push you, I've always been a contrary character. So I've gone in every single different direction it's possible to go, and I've probably sort of gone around in so many circles that I've almost spun myself into the ground. But what it's done is made for an enormously entertaining career. And then when I was 40 and I started writing and combining the words and images within the books, that just took on a whole new arena.
Well, your artwork is so really devilishly complex. You know, it just sort of sucks you in, and then once you start looking at it, you go from one image to another, and then you can come back again and see different things. And you never get tired of looking at your artwork. It's really quite amazing.
Well, the whole idea is that we have two main forms of perception. One is our understanding the world through words and the communication through words. But then there is the visual world. And the two sides of our brain, our intuitive and our logical sides, tend to drop. Not neatly, but they do tend to drop into those two sides. And most of us function throughout our life in a somewhat unbalanced way. We're either leaning all one way or the other, towards intuition or towards logic. But the book and my own life, I guess, has been a pursuit of a balance between the two.
When the first book was done, The Extraordinary Correspondence, how did they decide? Was it a difficult decision for them to decide to do such a complex book where there would be parts where people would open, there would be envelopes inside? This is not an easy printing.
Well, no, nothing had been done like that before. It was one of those circumstances, the kind of natural timing. I went along to them with the idea for the book. I had a little bit of a background in pop-up books, so I understood that it's actually relatively simple to put an envelope into a book. I mean, the physical doing of it is not that tough. Envelopes can be pre-stuffed mechanically. And back in 91, Singapore and Hong Kong just started to come on the scene wanting to do a lot of the West's printing. And they'd got a whole new load of machinery. And there was a huge amount of competition. So Chronicle Books, who are a publisher, went to a few printers and said, okay, who can do a good job on this? And consequently, they were actually able to get, even though the book had four stuffed envelopes in and was full color and all of those things, they were still able to actually manage to get it out in the market for under $20. And I think that made a huge, huge difference, because people were looking at that book and seeing how complex it was, whereas they'd look at a regular novel, which was actually costing more money. So when the book was released in September of 91, back then, of course, there was no internet to promote things. Everything was done by word of mouth. And something extraordinary happened. And over a period of 2 or 3 months, it just went berserk. It went to number one on most of the bestsellers throughout North America and stayed there for 2 years, along with the books that followed.
Well, I know when I first saw it, I was amazed that they had published it like that, because obviously, it is the way you envisioned the story. You want people to get that feeling that you have,
right,
that textual feeling and the excitement of a letter, because it is so exciting.
It's a physical experience. You could in some ways call it one of the early interactive books. But more than anything, it was a form of voyeurism with permission. So you actually got to read somebody else's mail, which, in itself is sort of essentially indulgent.
Well, and you say that, I know that you started writing late in your life, but boy, oh boy, you're one heck of a writer.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Well, I've been lucky. Very, very few artists get to actually have a large audience, and I got to discover, let's say at the age of 40, something that I also enjoyed doing. And by combining words and images, I was entering into a new territory. So I didn't have any restrictions. I could just kind of make it up as I went along. And, of course, then that opened the door, and there were six other Griffin and Sabine books altogether. There was the last one coming, the first guy coming out last year. But I've also done another, I kind of lost track, about 25, 26 books over that period of time, because the doors were open to me.
And, of course, the Pharaoh's Gate that came out last year, people had been waiting for that for 25 years. They were like, when is it coming out? When is it? And they were so happy. I know my brother, like, oh, it's finally here. You know, so it was an exciting process that your characters are so memorable that, I mean, people, I think partly because of that feeling of opening their letters, getting really intimate with them, your readers know your characters so well.
Well, what's interesting is what happened in the 25 years before the first one in this one, because we entered the sort of full flood into the electronic age, and we actually have many younger people now who struggle to read handwriting. I mean, they're just so unused to it. So it was interesting the way the publisher had to market the book, because this last one was very, very different to the first one, because it was almost like reintroducing the notion of actually what a letter was. I mean, I spoke to someone in their early 20s the other day, and they just basically didn't have a clue how to post a letter.
Well, it's true. This is the age of texting and all this epistology, which is the art of writing novels with letters, is now becoming the art of writing novels with tweets.
Oh, it is true. And in fact, the first book I did after the first three Griffin and Spain series was actually a book called The Venetian's Wife, which was right at the time when people were just starting to have email accounts. And The Venetian's Wife was actually a story told in terms of emails being sent between a ghostly machine and a person living in San Francisco. So it was very, that transition was actually quite natural in many ways.
Well, I do think that the younger generation is now starting to appreciate letters. I know quite a few young people who go around to, antique stores and places like that, and they want to actually collect these letters. And
with the exquisite handwriting, that sense of sort of disappearing more slowly into somebody else's world. I mean, one of the emails are great. I mean, tweets I'm not that great big a fan of, because that really does start to sort of shrink things down in an Orwellian way. But I think people are starting to discover that if you want to express something in a slower, more heartfelt way, emails tend to just be a little bit too fast and impersonal. And the one thing about letter writing is you can take a day to write a letter, to actually really express what you feel, to lay down the nuances of your emotions, whether they be love or hate, you can actually express yourself more fully. And the other thing is, when you receive a letter and you read it again, you can somehow it encourages you to move into a slower, more thoughtful place, where you're actually able to string your ideas together and attach them to your emotions.
Well, it is so lovely that you have, because of these books, and it's opened up the entire world of art to you, so that you can use your art to express so many things, even in something like, what was I looking at recently? The Egyptian jukebox.
Yes.
Something like that must have been fun for you to do.
Oh, the Egyptian jukebox, which is a pictorial conundrum for adults. It's a long time since I did that, but actually, right now, the book that I'm working on at the moment is a book called Dubious Documents, which will be coming out out late next year, which is actually in some ways a combination of what went on in the Egyptian jukebox and to some extent the sort of at least the Griffin's Bean format. So I'm back currently working on a complex conundrum or puzzle, which I think essentially is at this stage frying my brain.
Well, I think I like the Egyptian jukebox, so I'm looking forward to the new book.
Thank you.
Now, one of the things I want to tell everyone that you have a wonderful website and that they should go to it, and it's just nickbantock.com, and you have there, the story behind some of your work. Also, people can buy some of your artwork, which is lovely.
In fact, there's a number of ways in which you can see my work. These days, people tend not to use websites so much, but I do have an Etsy store. I do post on Instagram, and there's, I think, over 500 pieces up there if people want to go along and look at that. And also, I post a Facebook page, which is open to everybody. I usually put something up about once a week, and that could be a little tiny 100-word story, or it could be some comment on life, the universe, and everything.
Well, as I said, your artwork is so compelling because just to click on it to look, you start looking at one of the pieces, and you're like lost in it. You could be lost for a long time because there's one that I particularly like. It's called Finnish Huns. I'm from Northern Michigan and I'm Finnish background. And so when I saw that, it just was so intriguing, and I'm staring at it and looking at it, and you can come back to it and always find something new in that.
Well, you touch on another point there, because it's this business, this whole business about, you know, us being able to sort of slow down and actually become involved with something for more than 2 or 3 seconds. I try and create artwork that is rich enough so that you're, as it were, sort of fall in through the window into its mythology, so that you actually want to stay with it for a length of time and look. If you think back to, you know, the 1500s, 1600s, when people looked at a painting, there was no visual competition. People were actually used to looking at a painting for a very extended period of time, you know, anything up to an hour, which meant that when the artist was creating their piece, they knew that they had an audience that they could deliver a message to in a sort of slow-timed way. But our sort of post-Warhol culture, everything is very much you see it in 3 seconds and that's it. I think more than anything, we all, me included, need to constantly find ways to step outside the kind of over-plugged-in universe that we live in that doesn't give us breathing space to think.
And just slow down a little.
Yeah, exactly. Just take a few breaths. I mean, how many times do you walk down the street and someone bumps into you because they're texting and you realize they have no idea what's going on in the world around them? The sun's shining, you know, the birds are singing. There is so much going on that they're not seeing. And then the next thing, you know, 50 years have gone and they pop their clogs.
Exactly.
Using English expression.
Now, of course, were you always interested in postage stamps? Did you collect postage stamps when you were a kid?
I did. As a kid, my dad had a collection which I poured over, and then I kind of personally forgot about them for many, many years. And then back when I was doing book covers in London in the, in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, I was doing a book cover that needed the composition of it needed a Spanish stamp from 1945, And I went down a local little stamp store and got chatting to the guy there and just got hooked, basically. I just became fascinated by this little world that was an intense concentration of geography and history. And my geography and history at that point was pretty poor. But through stamps, I found a way into a kind of curiosity of the world. And that combined with its kind of art element, I guess it was the perfect miniature visual encyclopedia.
And you're right, because stamps open your mind to so many things, not just to the art, to the geography, to the history, because the stamps tell a history. You learn about people that... It's a fascinating way to study.
Well, if you've only got to look at, say, the stamps of 1918 and 1945 at the end of both wars, and to see how the world geography changed after those world wars, and you can see that through stamps. And it's that kind of thing, as you discover that, you know, when I was at school, I kind of was more interested in girls and soccer than I was interested in learning. So when I went to art college and I started reading fairly voraciously, I was looking to re-educate myself, or actually to educate myself. And that combined with listening to the BBC radio, in many ways, I feel like I'm self-taught.
Well, you're... beautifully taught, because you taught yourself not just your art, but writing. And as I said, what I love about your writing style is that it's so vital. One reads it and it's almost like we're just talking. You're just talking your writing. And so
it's voice. It's about, you know, I think one of the great advantages by not going through college and being, you know, taught how to write and looking over my shoulder at, you know, what Dickens or Faulkner said. But when I started to write, I actually was writing the way I spoke. And in Griffin and Sabine, it was really a matter of dividing two parts of my internal self and them entering into what you might call a Gestalt dialogue. So I would sit in one chair and I would be Griffin, and I had Griffin's pen and wrote in a certain way, and then I would move to another chair and I would be Sabine, who had a different pen and she wrote in a different way, and the art also had that same split. So I think the voice that came out of that was one that was both dual and natural. I wasn't trying to be a wordsmith. I was just trying to get a narrative down onto paper.
Well, you've done a beautiful job of it. And I wanted to tell people also that on your website, you have a blog. And one of the blog that you have there are a list of books that have influenced you. And I found it so fascinating. One, I always like to see if I've read the same books that other people have read.
Yes, yes.
And I did a lot of them, but there were a few that I found that I hadn't, and so it's really exciting.
Good. I've moved from blogs to putting that information out on my Facebook page. But you know, from time to time, I'll put up a list of books or movies or even, you know, high end TV shows. Just to sort of share a dialogue with other people, you know, about what's good, what actually lasts. One of the interesting things I think about going back and reading books that you read many years ago, sometimes they stand up and you read them again. You read them in a very different light because of the years that have passed. But nevertheless, they still very, very strong. And then others, you start to read and you go, oh my God, it doesn't work anymore. And that fascinates me.
Well, I I found your list fascinating, and I think it, as I said, some of them I had, most of them I had read, and then some it reminded me that I should go back and read them again, because I hadn't read Laurie Lee for a long time.
Laurie Lee and H. E. Bates, two, I think, the best British writers. And they've kind of, I wouldn't say slipped into obscurity, but they've sort of, they've got pushed back down the pile. And both of them, absolutely exquisite writers. And another British writer that's hardly known over here, probably one of the best fantasy writers, was a man called Mervyn Peake, who wrote the Gormagarth trilogy. Amazingly visual material. You're one of those books that you start to read and you just completely and utterly disappear into another world.
Well, I think your list is fascinating, and I hope that my listeners will go to it and also to your Facebook page so that they can see your art and be swept into it like I am every time I look at it. And so you're going to, your next book is coming out when?
The next book comes, well, actually, I've got a little tiny pop-up book coming out at the end of this year for Christmas and Valentine's. I every now and again, I set myself a little task, and the task I set myself was to create a Valentine's book that wasn't cheesy. It's actually a little tiny pop-up book of the heart, each of our hearts seen from a different perspective. I won't spoil it any more than that. And it's called My Foolish Heart. But then next year, the Dubious Documents book comes out, which is a big, much more sort of grand scale thing. And that should be out by the beginning of next year.
Okay, well, maybe you can come back in December when we're doing my Christmas recommendations, and you can talk about your book.
Well, by then people will have seen My Foolish Heart, and so maybe yeah, that is it's very interesting. Sometimes the simple things you do turn out to be the ones that, you know, reach people most easily.
Exactly. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today, Nick. I'm honored to talk to you because you are really quite amazing, and I am so very happy that I was able to fulfill my brother's dream to have.
Always a good thing to do.
Yeah, you know, I asked my brother and his wife, who do you want on the program, and they both said at the same time, Nick Bat, because they have your books, they love them, and I just want to thank you again for being on the program. Okay, and I'll have you back soon.
Very welcome.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Okay, take care, everybody.
Okay,
bye.
Wow, that's nice. We're going to do one commercial right now, and then we're going to be right on with my next guest.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest, Renee Garrison. We'll be talking to her in just a minute. I just want to remind everyone again that my first guest His name is Nick Bantock, B-A-N-T-O-C-K. You must really go to his website. It is it's a fascinating website with all of his artwork, and I think you will really enjoy it. Now, I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Renee Garrison. Hi, Renee, are you there?
I am. Thank you, Patsy.
Oh, wow, Renee. It's so nice to talk to you. I know that we have a mutual friend, Jim Lamb.
And, we do.
And he is always so enthusiastic about you and your writing. And he, the minute that it came out that you were part of the, what do we call it? The my mind went.
That's all right. Mine leaves me frequently. Yeah, don't worry.
You know,
it'll come
back. I was talking to Nick Bantock, and he was over there in Canada, and I had been worried. I wasn't sure, you know, if I would have any problems getting through to him, and but he's in over there in Vancouver, and we had no problems, so it's nice.
Fantastic.
It's nice, but I know that you are, of course, a Florida writer, and so
I am.
So I didn't have to worry about getting you on the line. But
no, Jimmy and I are old colleagues. We worked at the Tampa Tribune together for a number of years.
Yeah, I know. And he was so excited when your book came out. I love the name, The Anchor Clankers. That's a great name.
You know, actually, it was a derogatory term that the local boys in Sanford used for the midshipmen at the private boarding school. So it kind of was born of a little bit of ridicule, but I loved it and thought it would make a great name for the book.
Well, I think it made a great name, and it's also a beautiful cover. And, of course, you won the Florida Authors Gold Medal. Gold medal,
yes.
Isn't that nice? 2017. Florida Authors and Publishers Association for Young Adult.
Yes, I did. I was delighted. My book came out, it was released on July 20th. So I really didn't think I would have it in time to even enter in the book awards competition. I mentioned it to my publisher, and she said, no, you'll have an electronic copy. They don't take things in the binding. You submit an electronic version. So on the last day that you could, on June 5th, I submitted the book with, you know, my breath held. I thought, the jury probably isn't going to even want to read this because it's the last gasp of the deadline, 5 o'clock on the last day. So I was doubly thrilled when it won. I was very tickled.
Well, I think that's so exciting. And now, is this your very first book, first published book?
Yes. Very different from newspaper reporting, I can assure you. Whole new learning curve for writing a novel.
So, wow, you know, you're coming out right out of the gate. You're a winner.
Well, it was a nice blessing. Let's just say it was a good pat on the back for a novice novelist.
Well, you know, when I got the book, I said to myself, I wasn't sure if it was just, you know, very, very light summer reading. But this story has such depth. I was very, very pleased with both of your character development, the character. Tell us a little bit about the story, and then I'll tell you why I liked it so much.
Well, the lead character is a 14-year-old girl who never had a brother, but she acquired over 100 of them when her father became the commandant of the Sanford Naval Academy, a boys' military academy in Florida. Her family moves into an apartment on the first floor of the school. The boys are in dorm rooms on the second and third floor above her, and she begins a rather lonely process of trying to fit in, which I should add here is a fictionalized account of my own life. My father was the commandant of the Sanford Naval Academy.
Ah, okay. I didn't get that. Okay. Well, now I see why you really know this story.
My father used to come into the apartment some evenings after dealing with high school boys because it was grades 9 through 12, and he would take off his hat and look at my mother and say, "I ought to write a book." And unfortunately, he and my mother passed away before they could do it, so I was very happy to be able to do it for them, actually. I dedicated the book to my parents.
I saw that. I noticed the dedication right away. And what I wanted to say is why I like this book so much is I loved the relationship of Suzette with her parents.
Oh, they, good. They That's high praise coming from you, Patsy. I appreciate that.
You know, they were so realistic. Sometimes, you know, the parents in a story like this will be sort of fluff and not have substance. But here, I mean, I really had a feeling for this father and for the mother. I thought this was just beautifully written.
Thank you. One of the statistics, I myself was a Navy brat. My father was a Navy pilot, and we were transferred every 3 years, whether we liked it or not. And I can assure you, as a child changing schools, I did not like it at all. I read a statistic recently that according to the National Military Family Association, military children will say goodbye to more significant people by age 18 than most people will in a lifetime. And I wanted to kind of focus on that isolation that comes with moving. In my instance, of course, my character moves from Boston to Florida and suddenly winds up living in a school with boys. But I think her experience in moving and relocating and starting to change schools is kind of a universal theme among many families and many teenagers. So I kind of focused on that.
And you certainly captured it. The relationship between the girl, Suzette, and her parents is very touching, but very realistic. And then how she has to fit in with that many boys.
Yes. Yes, and it doesn't help that she's legally blind and refuses to wear her glasses, which, of course, I refuse to wear my glasses because boys don't make passes at girls who wear glasses. Or at least they didn't then when pink and blue were the only two frame colors that you could choose from. No one ever said that was particularly attractive. So when I would look at, for example, the lobby, which was called the quarterdeck at the school, when I would look at a room full of boys in uniform, they all kind of blurred together. I really couldn't distinguish one face from another. So that might have been an advantage at the time, now that I look back.
Yeah, I was just thinking, that might not have been so bad, actually.
No.
Yeah, so you couldn't see what the look on their faces. But you write it with a great deal of charm and humor. And
Thank you.
Also, it touches on a very serious subject, too. You know,
which
there's
is?
Some controversy about you know, just the whole growing up in this kind of a situation.
Once upon a time, I think, particularly in the South, boarding schools, because of their smaller class size and the structured environment and the 24-hour supervision, were considered kind of the primary vehicle for raising young gentlemen to embody the values of integrity, honor, duty, and service to others. Of course, when my father accepted the job and had a 14-year-old daughter, I couldn't attend school there, so the character in the book, as well as in my own life, had to be sent to a parochial school off campus, because one of the things parents at military boarding schools did not want was girls. So I had no opportunity to interact, at least on an academic level, with the young men who were students there. Now I think more of the schools still in existence are actually co-ed. I believe Admiral Farragut High School in St. Petersburg, Florida, is a co-ed campus.
Yes.
But back in, you know, 20 years ago, if it was a military boarding school, they did not want girls. So I was an anomaly at the time.
Well, I know quite a few of the students at Admiral Farragut, and it is co-ed now. Much different from what it was 20 years ago, that's for sure.
Much different.
So tell me, you know, when you decided, now you've been, of course, you're a solid writer, you know how to write, you've been in newspaper business for many years, but still, when you sit down to write a novel, it's a different process, isn't it?
Very different process. Some days the words flow pretty freely, and suddenly you'll have, thousands of words on the computer. Other days, you can sit there and stare at it, and nothing comes. I had the pleasure of interviewing the author Andrew Gross, who at one point was a co-author with James Patterson, which is not a bad knee to learn at. I interviewed him at Book Expo America in New York at the Javits Center. I was covering it for the Tampa Tribune, but in all honesty, I was also doing a bit of reconnaissance work on the publishing industry because I was in the process of writing my own book, so I thought, learn as much as you can, you know. You have the greatest number of publishing people in the smallest possible space in New York City, so ask away. And when I interviewed Andrew Gross, his big tip was sometimes his best work came on the second or third draft. So when I would sit at the computer and nothing was flowing, and of course when you're writing a book, it's not the same as daily newspaper deadlines where you have an editor hovering around saying, are you ready yet? Ready for me to read that yet? So there's no prompt here at your home computer. I thought, if I don't have a first draft, I can't revise it and make it better. So even when things seemed stilted and I didn't like the way it sounded and I couldn't make a transition from one paragraph to another, if I just got something down, if I just got a first draft, Andrew Gross was completely right. The second one was better and the third was better than that. So some days were easier than others.
Now, how did you find an agent? Did you find an agent?
Well, bless your heart, I did not find an agent, Patsy. That is another humbling experience of writing your book. I have 50 rejection letters in my email basket on my computer. You know, when I started first submitting letters, there were the Twilight series. Well, there are no vampires or werewolves in my book. Then there were the Hunger Games, and my book does not deal with a dystopian society. And then, of course, we had The Fault in Our Stars, and none of my characters are dying of an incurable disease or cancer. So,
please don't. I get so many of those books. I don't.
Gotcha.
I can't get
one. You know, I just, those seem to be the big sellers, though. So when I would submit to literary agents, I got some of the loveliest form rejection letters. I'm so sorry, this just doesn't fit in with what I'm looking for, but I wish you well with your writing career, and some other agent may feel differently than I. So when I was going to Book Expo America, my editor at the Tampa Tribune said, well, focus on Florida stories or Florida authors or things to do with the state. Made perfect sense to me. So I discovered the Florida Authors and Publishers Association and emailed the president, asked if I could meet with them. While they had a booth at Book Expo, and I did, and I chatted. And the woman who is current president of the Florida Authors and Publishers Association also owned Southern Yellow Pine Publishing, a small independent press in Tallahassee, Florida. And we were chatting, and I mentioned kind of an outline of what I was working on. And she said, well, when you have it in, you know, final form, I would like to read it. And I thanked her and schlepped away, covering the Javits Center in my sneakers. And later, after I did finish it and polish it, I was tired of just submitting query letter after query letter after query letter to New York publishing agents, and I thought, I'm going to send this to Southern Yellow Pine. And she was interested, and she offered me a contract. So this book was published without benefit of a literary agent, just a wonderful woman who liked my story.
Well, I think she made a good decision, because I think it's a great book, and as we now know, it is a gold medal winner.
Yes, that is a lovely thing. I unfortunately, the medal that I received is kind of a loud, flashy piece, so I can't wear it to the grocery store. But I contemplated it when I got home that day.
I don't know. If I take you out to lunch one day, you're over in my end of town, I'll take you out to lunch, but you have to wear it.
It's a deal. I will actually be in your end of town because I'm very happy to say that the Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading has asked me to present my book and to be a speaker in November. So I am thrilled that, ironically, a year ago at the Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading, I signed the contract with Southern Yellow Pine Publishing there so they could get some publicity pictures. And I cannot believe how fortunate I am that a year later I'm going to be a presenter at the Festival of Reading. I could cry when I tell you this. I'm very, very, very happy.
Well, with your gold medal, and I'm taking you out to lunch. I'm taking you out to lunch, and you're going to wear it, and I'm going to point to her, and I'm going to go to all the way to, you see this gold medal? I'm with a gold medal.
Fantastic. We could say that it was a Nobel Prize for Literature or something. It would be great, too.
Well, I think it's a wonderful honor, and I'm sure you're going to get more. You have to submit this to other places, and you'll get more prizes. But it is always so exciting the first time. And I must say, the publisher did a great job with the cover. I love that cover.
Thank you. We were working. She has five artists that she works with. And the first couple that came out, it's almost like having a baby. You know, when they put it in your hands, you look at it, and you just know that it's your child. And the first few attempts by the artist at a cover design, I looked at, and I thought, oh, no, that's not, no, and I am not artistic at all. I write, words are my thing. I cannot color. I do not draw. But I looked at the sample covers and thought, this isn't resonating with me. I don't really like this, and I didn't want to offend the artist who had submitted them. So I sent them to some of the gentlemen who are graduates of the Sanford Naval Academy just to do a random poll of what they might think was appropriate. And one of them was described as Thurston Howell III's hat from Gilligan's Island, and I thought, well, we can dismiss that one. And another one, people said, looked like a playbill from a Broadway musical, and I thought, no, you're right, that's not what I had in mind either. So it was, laboring over the cover was almost as difficult for me as writing the words inside of it. Anyone who says you can't judge a book by the cover is lying. I have often picked up books at the library or Barnes & Noble, and you look at them, and I don't even crack the cover if it doesn't attract me from the outside. So that was a source of anxiety. I had a stomach ache for a couple of weeks until we found this particular graphic. I didn't want any faces that were recognizable on the cover. I wanted every reader to imagine themselves as Suzette, the 14-year-old commandant's daughter, which meant no eyes, nose, and mouth, nothing that if I were looking and it didn't look like me, I would immediately think, oh, it's, you know, someone else.
Yeah, it works. It works.
Good. I'm so happy to hear you say that, because I kept looking at the mood boards that I was sent from the artist thinking, no, that's not my kid yet. That doesn't look like me. I don't like that one. And it was a difficult period, because I thought, if we get the cover wrong, no one's going to read the inside of it. So,
well, I think it's a wonderful choice. It's very noticeable, wonderful on Amazon, because it catches your eye. So I think it was a great choice.
I'm delighted to get an outside opinion, because my husband is sick of listening to me wail about this. So I'm very happy to get someone who doesn't live with me to get their opinion. This is
well,
good.
You know, Renee, I think you've done a beautiful job. It's really quite amazing that it's a first novel with such depth. That's the important thing. And I know that your parents would be so very, very proud of you.
Thank you.
Because it is a wonderful book. And I'm just proud to have you on Joy on Paper.
Well, it's my pleasure. I was so happy when when Jimmy suggested this. And I understand you had some surgery not too long ago, so I hope you're doing better.
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm hopping around again. Kickboxing is always, a little bit too much kickboxing. I was kicking too hard, I guess.
Another sport that I shall never attempt. Thank you for the update. Good to know how you hurt your foot. I will not be in kickboxing anytime soon.
That's all right. I did it for many years before this happened. So it's, one of the things.
Okay. That's good. I can rule that one out. Well, that's another one not on my dance card.
Okay.
Perfect.
Well, when you start, jumping with a parachute or, something like that.
Maybe for the next book, I'm hoping that I will do a series of the Anchor Clankers. The next book, I would like to be her sophomore year because she is a little bit more comfortable in her skin by the second year she lives there. So,
I have a feeling. As I was reading it, I was saying to myself, this is going to be a series. I know this is going to be a series.
Great. I described it to someone as sort of Hogwarts without the wizards and wands. Boarding school, no magic.
Well,
fun.
Just fun. And in Florida, what can go wrong with that? That's always fun, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you again for being on. I'll see you in November for lunch.
Yes. Yes, you will.
And then I will have you on when the next one of your Anchor Clankers comes out, okay?
Oh, that would be wonderful. Thank you so much, Patsy. It's been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed it.
Okay. Thanks, Renee. Bye-bye now.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, she's nice. Oh, she's nice. And the book is Fun Read. I would highly recommend it to anyone who has teenagers and young adults in their family. And what the heck? I'm not a young adult. Exactly. Just mentally. But I enjoyed the book because, as I said, her characterization, her plot development is excellent, and I thought it was a very touching story. So it's called Anchor Clankers, and it's by Renee Garrison, and it's available on Amazon. And the nice thing is she won the gold medal, and it's also set in Florida, and I love books set here in Florida, so that I know that she has a lot of interesting little side stories that are fascinating, and I'm sure that you will enjoy it. Now, I want to tell everyone that in September, I have Nelson DeMille on the program. Nelson DeMille, I'm just ecstatic. I of all the authors I've wanted to speak to, Nelson DeMille is right up there on the very top. Above, really, I can't think of anybody who is higher than him on my want list. So I'm so excited that Nelson DeMille is going to be on Joy on Paper. Now, as I said, go to Nick Bantock's page and enjoy his art. And remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. So take time and sit down and read and write and dream. And meanwhile, remember, don't let anyone steal your joy. Treasure it and share it. This is Patsy with a Z, hoping that you will say something nice to someone today. I will say something nice first to Jim Lamb for telling me about Renee Garrison. And then to Big Ed in the control room, I want to thank him for everything. He's always so good to me, and I really appreciate it. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him, because I'm feeling very military after reading Anchor Clankers. Bye-bye now.